Fish and Game Restaurant in Hudson, New York, is a leader in the local foods movement. Its core approach, engaging intimately with nature, both wild and domestic, building relationships with farmers, and exploring the joys of fermentation. Established in 2013, Fish and Game, with its chef owner Zachary Palacio, has received national accolades and honors, including the 2016 James Beard Award for Best Chef in the Northeast. Their new book, Project 258, Making Dinner at Fish and Game, presents an enticing selection of seasonal recipes, profiles of key producers who supply the restaurant, and a fascinating, beautifully illustrated look at the processes, both intellectual and culinary, behind the food at Fish and Game. To tell us more about the restaurant and their new book, we welcome Zachary Palacio, author of Eat With Your Hands. Before opening Fish and Game, he was the chef owner of Fatty Crab and Fatty Q in New York City. Peter Barrett also joins us. He's a painter, writer, and photographer, and was artist in residence at Fish and Game for 2 years, which sounds like a really, really cool gig. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. And we welcome both of you to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, very nice to have you on the program. I will, just for the listener's sake, I will tell them that the studio smells marvelous. and you are to blame / we celebrate you for that. So thank you very much.
A little fishy funky.
Fishy funky, yes. A term I weirdly have, the second time I heard that this week. Isn't that strange? The new book, Project 258. What is Project 258?
Project 258 is a number on a list of many projects, a long list. So Project 258, the idea behind naming it that was that this is just another thing that we set out to do, although perhaps more involved than some of the tasks on the list. It was yet another task that we've given ourselves in our very busy lives. Fish and Game, when we opened it, set out to both produce a lot of the food that we actually serve in the restaurant, as well as then cook that food in the restaurant, buy certain types of wine, source and work with local farmers to shape exactly what they're growing and understand what grows well in the Hudson Valley. So it's a very intimate and involved experience that goes well beyond the normal kitchen in your average restaurant.
Which means, and I assume this is an accurate number in the sense of that there were 257 other things that you've been up to.
Oh, yeah, it's completely accurate.
At least.
At least.
We're up to 712 now.
All right, so let us talk about how you landed in Hudson and the idea behind the restaurant of what you wanted to accomplish.
I landed in Hudson. We began vacationing, my wife and I, in Old Chatham, weekending. In 2005, and a family property up there. We started going up there on weekends, and our weekends kept extending into Monday, or, you know, we drive back early, get up at 5 in the morning on Monday to drive back to the city. We were living in Manhattan at the time, and we soon realized that we wanted to find some way to migrate north and move to the Hudson Valley. We took on a project of renovating an old barn on the property in Old Chatham in Columbia County, and that sort of prompted us to be more aware, I guess, or more attuned to opportunities that are happening in the area, and somewhat unconsciously. And through a friend, we met a couple who had a house near Hudson, and the guy and I became very good friends. His name is Patrick Milling Smith. Patrick bought a property in Hudson, and one thing leads to another. Next thing you know, Patrick and I strike up a deal to renovate a old blacksmith shop in Hudson on South 3rd Street in Hudson, New York, and we embark on yet another construction project, and that became Fish and Game. So we were sort of building and renovating a barn in Old Chatham as a place to live, simultaneous with renovating an old blacksmith shop in Hudson as a place to cook and work.
I assume you say, well, we landed in Hudson. Was this a restaurant that you could have or would have wanted to open, say, in New York City? Or is this a reflection of Hudson and where you landed?
The restaurant is completely a reflection of where we landed. And we happened to, you know, have this family property to which we were retreating almost every weekend from New York City. And the way we started eating, the farms that we sought out on our weekends, the manner in which we cooked shifted from using and having access to every ingredient under the sun in Manhattan and Brooklyn to focusing on what was growing, what we were picking up in these farmers markets, and trying to extract as much flavor as we could from fewer ingredients, and understanding the way that we enjoyed cooking, which is informed by cuisines from all over the world, how to bring those cuisines into sort of a more austere for a selection of ingredients, you know, fewer ingredients, but still just as much flavor.
The new book, Project 258, Making Dinner at Fish and Game. Zachary Palacio is the chef and owner. Peter Barrett is a painter, writer, and photographer, and as I mentioned in the introduction, was artist in residence at Fish and Game for 2 years. First of all, how do you get that gig?
Just lucky, I guess. I moved up to the Hudson Valley 10-ish years ago as a painter, as a full-time painter. And when the economy kind of threw a rod, that did a number on sales. And I had sort of coincidentally started writing about food just because I like to cook at home a lot. I have a big garden. And moving out from the city allowed me to have the time and space to do that sort of thing. And so I ended up as Chronogram's food writer for a while, and that led to a gig at Edible Hudson Valley. And I guess it was sort of fall of 2012, he called me up and said that Zach and Jory had moved up, and I knew Zach's cooking from Fatty Crab in Manhattan. And he said, they're opening something in Hudson and no one knows what it is, so go find out. And here's his phone number. And it took me about 6 months to sort of, because they were in the middle of construction and renovation and there wasn't anything to see. But by about February of 2013, we made a date and I came up and we hung out and I took a lot of notes and a lot of pictures. And then I came back the following week and then the following week and then the following week, because what they were doing was really interesting and we hit it off. And it kind of evolved organically on the basis of our personalities, and they liked what I was doing and I liked what they were doing, and it's sort of, I think we would be really good friends if we weren't working together. So we were kind of lucky in that respect because we just liked each other. So there was a high level of professional mutual respect and engagement on a serious level from an early point. But we also just enjoy each other's company, and that made it really easy.
So at what point did the project 258 come on your radar? Because I assume that you were largely responsible for this object looking as beautiful as it does,
well,
this book.
Yeah, we worked with a really talented graphic designer in Providence named Sarah Rainwater, but I definitely spent a lot of time looking over her shoulder, either physically or virtually. I would say, I think it was when that edible piece came out for the spring issue. They were pleased with it, and by then I'd spent so much time with them that I sent them an email saying, look, we should make a book, and the book should be about the passage of time and this very involved and very granular collaboration with the passage of time and with these ingredients and materials that come from this very diverse and fertile area. And they said, okay, because we've gotten some pitches from other people, but so far you're the only person who seems to really get what we're doing at this level. And we shook hands. It's almost exactly 4 years to the day ago that happened. So then we spent the next better part of 3 years putting this together.
Well, it is beautiful. I have to ask you, Zach, at what point did you think it was necessary for a restaurant, specifically your restaurant, to have an artist in residence?
I think from the moment that Peter and I got into a discussion about it, it just sounded like a good idea. And I had written a cookbook a few years earlier. And going through the process, I realized that there was something that I was missing. And it was that cooking the recipes and photographing them sort of take a day, 2 days, whenever a photographer is available. And you cook a number, maybe 20, 30 recipes at once, and then photograph all those in the same day, right. And you sort of lose the organic feeling, the process of the whole thing. The idea, even in just the creation of the object, the time that it takes to make these things and discover them. And with Peter, he's somebody who's close by, he's engaged, interested, and willing. to come in weekly and hang out with us. And we would hang out and we would do some work. And if we weren't in service that night, we'd hang out at the house or at the barn and drink wine. And, you know, I notice you're looking at a page where it's has some photographs of a barrel with fish aging in it.
Yes.
And those are barrels we have at our home in our barn. And we age fish sauce in our barn. So, you know, Peter was able to really spend time with us. And I've never seen a cookbook that was produced over this period of time. It's a documentation of the work done as opposed to a record of the work, right? It's a documentation over time.
Yes.
And that's unique. So I was turned on by the idea when he brought it up.
How much fish sauce do you need in a life?
You're asking the right guy.
Seems like you have a lot here. I mean,
we put it in everything, and if you, Scott, take some time to read through the book, I think there somewhere in there we discuss that there are three essentials to the cuisine at Fish and Game. There's the fish sauce,
right.
Maple syrup, and vinegar.
Yes.
And those came out of those three items, those essentials. Really came out of my time spent in Southeast Asia, where I fell in love with fish sauce, lime juice, and palm sugar. And these became sort of replacements. And as I said, finding ways to use the product available to us to extract a ton of flavor. So taking a nod from these dynamic, amazing cuisines of Southeast Asia, but utilizing what we have here, we're able to not reproduce that flavor, but create something all our own, understanding how to bring and pull out dynamic flavors from food using fish sauce, which is a great counter to salt for seasoning, and maple syrup, which is great, rounder, richer way to sweeten something other than using cane sugar. And then, of course, vinegar, which we make from spent wine in the restaurant, which my wife, Jory, wife and partner, Jory, makes from all, you know, at the end of the week when you have wine that was either bad or left over that's not going to last until you reopen the following week. We bring that wine home, or I bring it home in the truck, and I give it to Jory, and then she feeds it to whatever vinegar she's making. Also scraps from the restaurant, carrot peelings, carrot tops, almost anything that is not too raunchy, we'll end up putting into a vinegar. So we have all kinds, I mean, she has all kinds of spent bread that she mixed with cherry pits and a mother, and then wine. And she'll let that go for a year, and we'll have sourdough cherry vinegar. You know, it's
we have really the same amazing rules here at the round table. If it just isn't if it's like too raunchy of an idea, we'll pass it on. We'll put it on the show. What the hell?
Why not?
Let me ask you about the idea of a specific question about fish sauce, which is you put it in these barrels. They're oak barrels, so basically you're fermenting it, right? I mean, this is not much different than what you would do with say bourbon.
Sure. Sure. I mean, it does go through a process of fermentation.
Yeah.
And it's heavily, heavily salted, though. So there are enzymatic reactions that occur, especially when we do the guts of the fish, and they sort of feed on themselves. And, you know, the larger the barrel, the longer it takes, too. Smaller barrels take less time. So there are, at any one time, you walk into the barn, and there are fish sauces at different points of maturity.
So given the scrap nature of it, of what you put into it, does that lead to a consistency? Does that allow you a consistency of flavor, or is there a change, and do you like that?
There's definitely a change, and I think that I certainly enjoy it. It keeps me on my toes. Sometimes it can be frustrating because if I want to remove myself to focus on something else for a short bit of time, I have to have confidence that whoever is there, you know, watching the pass, as it were, which is the spot in the restaurant where the food passes through the chef to the customers, whoever's there needs to understand the nuances of what we do and understand it well.
I mentioned that the studio smells just beautiful, and so let us start this process. Where would you like to begin in giving us an idea of what happens at Fish and Game?
Well, this is a really cool product, and I hand-sliced this morning. We age our own prosciutto at our farm with pigs raised in Columbia County.
All right.
So this is prosciutto from a mule foot pig, and
now, what is it? What is a mule?
Mule foot pig is sort of like the it's what do they refer to it as the poor man's pelota negra or I'm you know it's
pata negra yeah
or the pelota
it's
pelota ham
one of the most endangered kinds of types of heirloom pigs.
I don't know why that was referred. Somebody, I think that was Christopher Williams, the guy who actually raised one of the one guy who makes whiskey in New York in the Hudson Valley from grain that he grows on his farm. Also, then takes the silage, takes the spent grain after fermentation, and feeds it to pigs and raises the pigs and sends them to us. And he referred to it as a poor man's Pata Negra or something else or some other breed he was referring to. And I think the reason is because the mule foot generates a lot of fat.
Okay.
It's a well marbled pig, in short.
And the prosciutto, obviously we can celebrate it for what it is, but then you can also cook with the prosciutto as well.
Sure, although we generally just serve it in its cured form. Form, yeah.
So it's except cooked, the bones. The bones get made into stock.
The bones get turned into stock. The skin gets turned into stock. The excess fat gets turned into stock. So, I mean, this is a uniquely Hudson Valley ham. You don't see this too often.
That is fantastic,
it's
beautiful.
It's two and a half years it's been hanging.
Really?
Yeah. And so it's really got some age on it.
Not overly salty.
Not overly salty. A little bit funky, but not...
Now, what is the funky?
It's just time. It's really... You just get a little cure going on. It's just air and time. It's not...
Because so often you're... I apologize for interrupting, but so often you are... beaten over the head by a curing or an aging or a smoke flavor, where this is a very light flavor, really.
As with the fish sauce, even things that are heavily salted can still undergo bacterial fermentation. There are lactic acid bacteria that thrive in a saline environment. That's how sauerkraut works. And so the ham, even though the purpose of the salt is both to draw out moisture and to make it very inhospitable to pathogens, there are still organisms that can live on the surface of the ham, and they do change its flavor. And the longer you let it sit, the more that change takes place.
And often, you know, you'll have a ham that might be assertively salty, and the purpose of that is to really destroy any nuance in the ham. So take a country ham, for instance, that you have to soak for maybe 24 hours before you actually serve it. It's just salted to the point where there's no bacterial development at all in the ham whatsoever. Speaking of bacterial development here, and pickles,
we so often do, yes,
right. And Peter mentioned sauerkraut, and of course the well-known Korean cousin kimchi is something that my wife and partner Jory Jane MD is her name, really has taken the lead on for Fish and Game and for herself as well. So this one happens to be ramps. So these are wild harvested ramps from last spring that I just tossed with some oyster mushrooms from Zare Brothers Mushroom Farm in Philmont just this morning. Just warmed them up. So the ramp kimchi she makes with aniseed. So there's aniseed in there and chili and a little bit of fish sauce. And she cures these, just like making a pickle, she cures them in a crock that's actually a German crock that's traditionally used for sauerkraut. She uses these German crocks to cure her, and that's an oyster mushroom there.
Okay.
And the slices, you can see the vegetal slices are the ramps, which are, you know, wild leeks that come up in spring,
all right,
early spring.
So should you eat them together?
Yeah, sure. That was my intention, is to have something that would be complemented by the ramp and absorb the flavor of the ramp kimchi. So this is a tip. This is typical of the flavors of Fish and Game, and this is something that I pulled from my pantry this morning. Fish and Game is closed for a break in March, and which is our typical time for a break. But the pantry at my house and the pantry at Fish and Game are pretty much identical. So I decided to pull some things, and I did. I made sure to have some prosciutto that I had down at the restaurant for you, because it is a particularly special thing that we do.
Now, the ramp itself that has a crunchiness to it, now how long has that been?
It's been in crock for probably 4 to 5 months, and then pulled out and then put into a gallon jar and put in our walk-in refrigerator.
So it's great that it doesn't lose the crunchiness.
It doesn't lose the crunchiness. It's never really fully cooked.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that's boiled out or cooked. It's put in, it's washed and put into the crock in its raw form.
So there's nothing soggy there. I mean, that is all just firm, delicious, and beautiful.
Yeah, I think so too. This is one of her this is one of I think both Jory and my favorite kimchis. So it is crunchy and yummy.
Now let me ask you in regards to the book. Let me keep the eyes on the prize here as far as the book itself, which is this will teach us to do what in our home.
It's a good question. What do you think it'll teach people to do, Peter?
Well, the ramp kimchi's in there. The prosciutto's in there.
That's right.
The bread that we haven't gotten to yet is okay. In there. We set out to do a few things with this book. One of them was to make, as you said so kindly earlier, a beautiful object. One of them was tell a story from a particularly embedded long-term point of view, which is uncommon in the industry. There are a lot of people who, you know, they book you for 2 weeks, you show up, you tell you take the pictures and you get out.
It's right. Money.
You're a hired gun, and it's an understandable business model, but the work product is a very different thing. And so we wanted it to be beautiful. We wanted it to be very thorough and comprehensive and really explain what it's like to do these things and what it's like to make this commitment to collaborate with your food sources. But we also wanted it to be a particularly useful cookbook, a culinary tool. And most importantly, now that we're in the age of these, ponderous coffee table books, all of which are so beautiful and so specific to their...
ponderous, yes.
They're useful in a bar fight. I'll give them
sure,
that.
Sure, yeah.
But so many of them, especially the wave of Nordic cooking that has kind of consumed the world for the last sort of half dozen, 10 years, they're so specific to their place, they're so true to their place, that they're not particularly useful as tools to people who live in a different part of the world.
Mm.
Because they're dealing with lichens and mosses and, you know, these very specific things. And we wanted, because these processes are universal, because fermented fish is made from the Arctic Circle to the tropics and everywhere around the world, because these principles of fermentation, these principles of growing food and processing it to eat, whether it's just by cooking or whether it involves fermenting, they're universal. So whether your protein is a deer or a kangaroo, this book will be equally useful to you. That was something that was important to us, that it be something that anybody could really get a lot out of.
Deer or kangaroo?
Just
another great band name. All
well,
right.
It's true, though. You know, the book is beautiful and it's large, and it could be looked at as just another sort of beautiful coffee table, ponderous coffee table book, as Peter said. But once you get in it, you realize it's not. It's not something that, you know, engenders feelings of inadequacy, you know, that that maybe some of these books do, where there's no way you'll ever recreate these,
right,
these things. The recipes here, they're doable. This is something you can do in a studio apartment, in the village, or on a 30-acre farm in Columbia County. You know, you can buy yourself a crock pot and make kimchi pretty much anywhere in the world.
I love the idea, as I was going through the book, that you have this food that is locally sourced. You're showing us how to, what you do, how you deal with this. And then you have a book that is published by the University of Texas. That's awesome.
And they're great people.
They are great people.
Yeah.
Well, despite being Texan.
Well, all right, I'll leave that to you. All right.
I'm just kidding.
Now,
his wife is Texan.
Yes,
oh, good.
My wife is from Austin. So.
Oh, there you go.
I'm about to feed you some. This is a fermented pork sausage, but it's a quick fermentation. And what we do in order to facilitate the fermentation, we use rice, and it's a locally grown rice. So we cook the rice, and then we coat the pork in the rice, and the rice grows bacteria very quickly and helps us sour the pork. And then I lightly cook the pork with a little bit of garlic. And to season it, I added some of, Jory makes a salted chili using olive oil. She salt cures chili and then packs them in olive oil. So the little bit of the salted chili oil dresses this. And then there's a radish that's dressed with a little bit of our fish sauce. So it's a big mouthful of flavors in a small spoon.
All right. Well, that is lovely. So
and, a lot and, going on.
Yeah. And do you worry about there too much going on, or is there no such thing?
There always is, but this happens to be a nice combination. It's not overwhelming. And this is sort of what I had for breakfast this morning. So I just, you know, I figured it would be appropriate because it really is something that I eat and is involved in my day to day. Peter eats this way. Jory eats this way.
Well, first of all, your breakfast rocks. That is awesome. There's a little kick, right? There's a little spice.
The salted chili oil
that
I coated
awesome.
The pork with. Yeah, it's cool. And the salted chilies themselves are delicious. This is just the oil from that process that I took out of the jar.
Now, at the risk of, I apologize for asking this, but can I just try the sausage?
Absolutely. Use the spoon. You
okay.
can dig right in.
All right. And yeah. and that is the that is really all of it, right? Or because it's mixed with rice.
The rice we remove once we cook it. So the
I
rice
see.
Is
so
just there
is
to
the
carry
sausage.
to sour the pork.
Well, that's amazing.
It's based off of a Thai recipe called Naem, which is spelled N-A-E-M. Which is in the book as well. That's
all right.
And the radishes are just simply dressed with the fish sauce, so you can eat them on their own too, and they've just got that. Instead of salt, you know, salted radishes are pretty typical. It's just a fish sauce radish.
That's a lovely, lovely combination. All right.
Thanks. Cool.
Finally,
we have a little bit of bread. This is a pan au levain. It's a natural sourdough starter that our baker, Walter Groves, keeps feeding. And what I did is we made a little bit of butter from milk from Hillover Healthy and Fresh Farms in Columbia County as well. And so we cultured not from the milk, it's from the cream. We cultured the cream, and then we whipped it, and then we pressed out the water, and we had cultured butter. But then I took garlic that we grew and has been sitting on top of in a jar on top of our water heater for 3 years, getting black. So it's black garlic, and there's a little bit of sea salt, and then just recently we tapped our maple trees, reduced some of that sap, so this has a little bit of our maple. So it's really a maple black garlic butter.
Wow.
All from products we made either on our farm or in the restaurant.
That is, well, first of all, it's beautiful. And again, a lot of different flavors going on in the butter.
And I would be remiss if I didn't say that the bread, the black garlic, the butter, and the maple are all in the book.
It just so happened. I don't know how that happened.
I know, right? What are the chances? Thank you.
Yeah. It's as if we planned it. That is remarkable. It is.
The bread was toasted a little while ago. Forgive me. I didn't know if you had a toaster here.
We do, but this is better. So the other thing too is just how remarkable, at least I think this is, that in the process that you described, that the maple is sort of one of many, and yet it is a very strong component.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure, and perhaps, you know, it's sweeter. I figured, you know, I would make it a bit sweeter to finish today's little sampling. If I were to serve this in the restaurant, and we have as just a side to go with bread, it would be far less maple. I would use the maple just to round out the flavors,
right,
and not to be as sweet forward.
So if we came to the restaurant, I mean, and I just said, and you serve this as a side, and I was to ask the server, well, can you just keep the bread and butter coming? I mean, is that a bad thing to ask for? Or
No, it's a great thing to ask
okay.
for if you're
All
liking
right.
something.
All right. All right. I don't want you
yeah.
to just think that, because in my family, they say, oh, don't fill up on the bread.
Right.
All right.
Right. Yeah, my mother used to say that to me, too. And I just learned to eat more. That was how I was trained.
And let us not forget the wine, which, by the way, is served in the coolest damn wine glass I've ever seen.
These are little cups. Jory has a thing for vintage glassware. So I just grabbed these this morning because they're small and durable, and I knew they wouldn't break on my drive up here.
They're very cute.
Yeah, they're little bartending glasses.
Okay, so tell us about the wine.
So the wine is it's a Pinot Noir from Burgundy, brought in by one of our favorite importers, and we have a selection of importers we use, who bring in wine that's made with minimal intervention, both on the farm, and that is in the vineyard as well as in the winery. So it's really just growing grapes, crushing the grapes, fermenting the juice, then bottling it. And in the most simple terms. And there are profiles of four winemakers. Peter went to France for this book. It's another thing he did along the way. He traveled a ton.
Good for you,
Peter. Spent time with us and traveled to France. You know, you put in the hard hours, eating and drinking wine.
There is no wine in team.
That's right. But he did clock a lot of miles on that quick little trip to France. But the producers are some of the producers. The producers in the book are producers we feature at Fishing Game. But the idea is the product we buy here, we don't look for organic certification. Mm-hmm. We know these people. We know how they grow things. We don't have to. They don't need to get some sort of certificate from the state or the federal government to prove to us that they've already proved to us, because we've walked their fields. We talk to them. We plan the crops with them for the following year. So we know what's going on. Same with, while we can't do that with all of our wine producers, we work with people who do and who can, who go and visit their producers they import. And they spend time with them. And these people are farmers primarily before they're winemakers.
Now, this wine would be served with what?
Anything. With the name, perhaps. You know, a nice sort of lean red wine to go with the spicy name. Not something that's too tannic or that's too jammy, but it has a nice cleanliness, and you get that sort of full mouthfeel from the pork. I think that pairing would be great.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah. It's worth noting also, especially with wine, because we all understand what organic produce is like. But organic on a bottle of wine, even if it's certified, there's still 50 things that can be added to that and not violate the terms of what that labeling requires. All kinds of extra sugar and colorants and tons and tons of commercial yeasts, which are bred to be consistent. Well, you were talking about consistency earlier. When you use a lab-grown yeast, you get the same flavor. Yeast brings a lot of flavor to the party. When you're fermenting a bunch of grapes that's seen very little chemical intervention in the vineyard and then is fermented only with the wild yeast that grows on the bunch of grapes in the mm-hmm. vineyard, those bring a lot of personality.
And are sort of the true definition of terroir,
exactly,
right? Sorry
exactly.
to interrupt.
No, not at all, but that's exactly it. So if you want a bottle of wine that is as representative of its place as possible, then you really need to have one that's fermented with the native indigenous yeast, which is a polyculture. There's a lot of different things going on there. And so what Zach was saying earlier, they work with these importers because these importers are the people who are out there making sure that the winemakers are doing it right, as it were, as opposed to taking shortcuts and going for stability and consistency over this more individual kind of expression.
I love that explanation because it is so detailed, and also because as you were doing it, Zach poured more wine.
to go back to this theme of consistency,
yes,
or not having consistency, I guess what is consistent throughout Fishing Game and that you see throughout the book is this commitment to products having a sense of place. If we're cooking in the Hudson Valley, the food we're cooking at Fishing Game is going to taste of the Hudson Valley.
Right.
Whether we cook it in a style that may be more Thai or more Italian, you know, those techniques are very relevant to what comes out on your plate, but it's not going to change the fact that the food will taste of the Hudson Valley because we're using those products that are grown in the Hudson Valley. Same with the wine. I mean, this wine tastes of Burgundy. You can't recreate that. And a great example is Sauvignon Blanc. People taste Sauvignon Blancs that are sometimes made with, you know, the grapes may be grown in France, but the yeast may be exported from Australia, and it may have tropical notes and tastes of, you know, smell of mango and bananas, and you know, it might be a familiar note on the nose of a Sauvignon Blanc, but that's not actually the taste of Sauvignon Blanc that's grown in France. And, you know, these bacteria and the yeast that grow and develop over time in cellars that are not filled with chemicals and not washed clean of, you know, walls that are thick with that white yeast coating.
The restaurant is currently closed. You're on a break. You'll be reopened.
We reopen on March 31st.
March 31st. Yeah. Meanwhile, the book is now out. Are you doing any events for the book?
We are going to be doing a bunch of events.
We have one local event we can plug. We're doing a signing Sunday afternoon, April 2nd, at our beloved Golden Notebook in Woodstock.
That is great.
We're going to be doing a number of events in the immediate area. We're holding off until we know the weather is going to work with us a little bit more. So come May, June, we'll be holding events in Hudson and in Woodstock and throughout New York. But before that, we're going to go out to California and pitch the book, and down to Charleston and work in some warmer climates. And it's a national release, so we want to get out there and do the whole show.
And it's obviously about the book, but also to celebrate the restaurant as well and the work that you do there.
Absolutely. I mean, the book is it's a great way to introduce people to what we do at Fish and Game. I couldn't be happier with it. I'm just, you know, I was looking at it this morning, and I'm so happy to see it every day. I sort of flip through pages each day and look at it again. I'm like, wow, this is really here. And what Peter and Sarah accomplished, and then along with my crew and my partners at Fish and Game, was just really amazing. I'm proud of everyone.
Congratulations on the James Beard Award. Congratulations on the book. I assume that's a big thrill to win that.
Yeah, that was great. That was great. The timing, I think, was fantastic.
Didn't hurt.
The book coming out,
yeah,
for sure. So,
you know, it's a nice thing to put on the jacket.
Yeah.
We signed the contract with UT Press in February, and Zach won in May, right, and they were beside themselves.
Yes, I bet they were.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, hopefully it helps sell books.
Yeah. The new book, Project 258, Making Dinner at Fish and Game, it is published by the University of Texas Press. You can find more about Fish and Game by going to their website, fishandgamehudson.com. fishandgamehudson.com. Don't forget the event coming up at the Golden Notebook as well, goldennotebook.com. I want to thank Peter Barrett and Zachary Palaccio for being with us and for bringing these wonderful flavors to our round table. I thank you very, very much for being with us. Congratulations on all of the good work and on the book. Beautiful stuff.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Project 258, Making Dinner at Fish and Game. It is published by the University of Texas Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.